All right. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Rick.
Hi, my name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic. December of 2016, I was supposed to speak here on the 21st, right before Christmas. And I ended up calling Billy about a month or so ahead of time and backing out because I had some things going on with my wife. She had some medical issues and stuff, and I was taking care of her. And so I came here to listen to Mandy speak here a while back, and I let Bill know, you know, that I was ready to do it again if he wanted me to. So he called me Sunday night and said that someone had backed out, so he needed someone to take their place. So here I am. That's full circle. I just did this over in Tulare a couple of weeks ago. Those of you that are here that were there, I'm sorry. I'll try to tell things a little differently, maybe, you know, throw some different stories in there or whatever. But it's pretty much, our stories are pretty much the same. I started drinking at, never felt like I quite fit in. Anybody ever have that one? Never felt like I quite fit in. And then when I was about 12 years old or so, maybe a little before then, you had the little sips of beer Dad would give you and stuff, and it's like, I really like that stuff, you know. I've always had an affinity for lager because my dad used to drink a cheap lager, you know, like the Lucky Lager that was like $3 a case at the time, and with the little puzzles on the cap.
Yeah.
I used to steal those from him when I got older, but my folks always kept a gallon of Red Mountain Vin Rosé in the kitchen cupboard. And they went out one night, and I think it was probably around 12, 13. They went out one night, and I knew they were going to be gone till late. They left me home alone. So I got the idea to go in there and grab that bottle of wine and just tip it up and chug it. Just chug, chug, chug till I had to take a breath and then put it down. And then I'd go do whatever and then come back. I did that like maybe 3-4 times. And I got pretty hammered and also got really sick. And I guess told my first lie as an alcoholic the next day, you know, when I just told him I was sick. You know, I didn't feel well. And I didn't stop, you know, that even though it was like a terrible experience, it didn't stop me. And I found out why later on, but so I was drinking more and more with my buddies and stuff, and I got to where I was smuggling that same wine to school in the morning. I would steal my mother's Tupperware, and I would pour a bunch of wine in that Tupperware and take it to work or school and drink it before I went in, and in the morning, and throw the Tupperware away. So, you know, Mom was probably always wondering where all her Tupperware was going. Then, you know, obviously I was doing terrible in school and stuff, and which I probably always was anyway. And because of the not fitting in thing. And alcohol made me turn me into a different person. And it turned me into somebody I liked, you know, because I didn't like the other person. And it turned me into somebody that was brave, outgoing, funny, I thought. All those things that I wasn't before. And so, like I said, I was doing terrible in school. So it came time to, I was coming up on my senior year of high school, and I was going to have to do another year because I was so behind on credits and everything. So I went to the counselor, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to drop out and go in the Navy. And she said, I think that's a good idea. And I thought that was, thinking back, you know, it's like, aren't counselors supposed to be encouraging your education, you know? But it was that, I was that bad, I guess, you know. So yeah, go, please. So then I told my parents, you know, and they said, we'll sign for you. And, because I was 17. So I ended up joining the Navy. This was in 1970. Vietnam was going on strong, you know. So I went in the Navy, went through boot camp, barely made it through boot camp because for some reason I had an authority problem. So, but barely made it through boot camp. One of the things I always say, a lot of you guys that know me in here say, have heard this before. It's like when my dad dropped me off at that building to get processed to go into the Navy. The last thing he said to me was he shook my hand and he said, no matter what they make you do, it's been done before. And I didn't think much of that at the time, you know, but well, I did carry it with me, you know. I thought, okay, I can get through whatever they got to hand out. But what I found out later was I use that in AA too. Because AA is the same thing, you know. You come in here green and you don't really know anything, how it works or whatever, and you get with somebody hopefully and they show you. But somehow while I was in boot camp, you know, they classify you as, because I went in there with no guarantees of nothing, you know, what any kind of occupation or whatever. But apparently, you know, parent-teacher conferences and stuff, the teachers would always say, you know, he's real smart if he just apply himself, you know, because I was a class clown and all that stuff. So, but apparently they were right because I managed to get classified as an aviation technician or aviation structural mechanic. So I made out pretty well. You know, I was able to have a decent occupation while I was in. And they sent me to school in Tennessee. After I finished that, I went, they put me in a squadron, and I went on the USS Midway, which is now a museum. That doesn't make me feel old at all. But, so I went overseas. I went overseas on the USS Midway. The longest tour they'd ever had over there, I think, was almost a year, 11 months. And it's funny because before I went, I didn't want to go. So I put in for a transfer, and it never happened. And so I ended up having to go over there. And then after I got back, they said, hey, there was some kind of foul up. Your transfer went through. You're going on the USS Ranger. You're going back over there again. So I went over there twice. The first time on the Midway for 11 months and the second time on the Ranger for about 6 months. The Navy taught me how to be, I guess it's different nowadays. They don't like you to drink and stuff. Back then, they kind of encouraged it. And they made me a functioning alcoholic. I was drinking on and off the job, you know. I can remember one time in the Philippines we were doing what's called a high power turn, where they put a new engine in the plane and they've got it chained down to the ground, and they're running it through these different RPMs and stuff, and it takes all day. They're running all these tests and stuff, and we're all drinking. We got a barrel of beer out there, and everybody's getting hammered, you know. And pretty soon the guy in charge, he just throws the stuff, you know. He's like, you know, he got mad, he yelled at us and stuff. But it was that bad, you know. And another thing too, I was thinking about the other day. When we pull into the Philippines, is where we went the most. And when we pull into the Philippines, everybody, they had these things called cattle cars. Remember those, Gary? What it is, it's a semi that's pulling this trailer. The trailer's made for hauling people, you know, so it's for transporting people. So as soon as the ship pulls in, they get the gangplank down. Everybody's wants to get to town, you know, because they've been out at sea for a month or so. And so they're scrambling for these cattle cars. They're diving in these things and stuff. Well, we had a beach detachment, what they call it, on that would stay. Like, we'd have one plane that we'd leave behind there usually for to work on. And the guys that were on the beach detachment, it was their job to be waiting on the pier with a squadron jeep with the back full of ice and beer. So all we had to do was step off the ship and crack one, you know, while everybody else is scrambling to get to town. So, booze was a big part of my Navy career. And then other things became a part of it too, which I'm not supposed to talk about here. But I am going to touch on that a little bit later, but not too much. But it's part of it, part of my story. So, so anyway, yeah, a lot of drinking in the Navy. And then I got out and went to go live with my parents in Sunnyvale, California, while I was figuring out what I was going to do. And racked up 3 drunk drivings the first year I was out. The first drunk driving I got, it was there in Sunnyvale. And I remember me and this buddy of mine, we were hammered, man. And we were in my truck, and we got pulled over. And the cops were going to haul me off. And I said, no, you're not. And they said, yes, we are. And I said, no, you're not. And you're not doing anything with my truck either. And fuck you. And I ended up getting sprayed in the face with mace, handcuffed and thrown in the back of the car. And they let my buddy take my truck and go home. And he was just as drunk as I was. I don't understand that. But I remember the next morning, you know, on the first page of Bill's story, on page 1, it talks about, I think that's where it is. Let me see. Yeah, it talks about where he went to visit. He says, we landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. Okay, my ominous warning was that morning when they let me loose. I remember sitting on the curb. You know, they kept me for the 8 hours or whatever to dry out, and then they let me go, turn me loose on my own recognizance. And I'm sitting on the corner waiting for my buddy to show up with my truck to pick me up. And my face is peeling from the mace and everything. I'm hungover. My eyes are burning. I'm a mess, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, well, I guess I've arrived. You know, this is my first drunk driving. And I knew it was bad. I knew it was an ominous warning. And Sure enough, like I said, within that year, I racked up two more. And I remember after that first, or no, not that one. There was another one where I was in my truck, and I drank a bunch of tequila. I was sleeping it off in my truck, and some guy come and woke me up. So I'm one of these guys that when I'm drunk, I love to drive. And so, and when he woke me up, I started up the truck and took off. Well, it was raining that day, so I went down to the end of the street and went to turn and punched it and got sideways and took out a fire hydrant. And I'm trying to start the truck to leave, to get away, and it won't start. So I'm standing there looking at this water shooting up in the air while the cops come and cuff me and haul me off. That was in Novato, California. I ended up at what they call the Blue Roof Inn, the Marin County Civic Center, in the county jail there. And they turned me loose at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I walked 10 miles, about 10 miles up Highway 101 back to Novato in the middle of the night. Good times. But when we finally found out where my truck was impounded and we went and got it, we're going to figure out what.
Can I borrow the microphone for a second?
Sure.
Silver GMC pickup alarm. Okay. Back to reality.
Okay. When I finally figured out where the truck was and we went to go get it, it turned out the little wiring harness that goes, that plugs into the firewall, we just had to push it in and it started right up. So anyway, I was back at my folks' house and I had a banged up fender. So I went to a wrecking yard, got a fender, and I'm out there trying to fix it. And this was another day, and I'm hungover. And I remember my dad coming out while I'm hungover and I'm trying to change this fender. And he goes, "You know you have a drinking problem, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I know," but I didn't care. I didn't care. Well, I used to brag about it. You know, people say, "Hey, Rick, how you doing?" I say, "Haven't seen a sober day," and I was proud of it. And you know, because like I said, it may be that person that I liked, and I hadn't hit that bottom yet. And so I went on for quite a few years after that, and somehow I moved to San Jose, spent some time there. I was working for my dad off and on, and I met this woman, and we ended up getting married. We ended up getting married. She had a few kids already, and then we had a couple more. And she was from here, and I didn't grow up here or anything. I'm not from around here. I've lived here a long time now, longer than I've lived anywhere in my whole life. She told me what a nice little town Visalia was and everything, and I fell for it, and we moved here. I've said this many times, you know, I don't know how the wives put up with us, you know, the ones that stay. You know, I don't know. They see something in us that nobody else does, you know, I guess. But we moved here, and we had a lot of ups and downs. She actually left me once, but she couldn't stay gone. But, and so, yeah, we had a lot of ups and downs. Finally, oh, and then I got into that stuff that enables you to drink more, like maybe 3 days without eating or sleeping. So was doing a lot of that. I had a job out at, because of my mechanical background, I've been a maintenance mechanic, like industrial maintenance mechanic for, since the late 70s, you know. So I had a job at the Pirelli plant over there in Hanford. And, yeah, that's another story. I worked there for 13 years until they closed the plant down. And all except for the last year, I was on swing shift. I finally made it to days that last year. But, yeah. I used to love foggy days because the cops couldn't see your beer, you know, when you're driving down that Houston Avenue from here to Hanford. And I used to throw the empties out, you know, so I wouldn't have no open containers. And I would get off work. Towards the end there, I would show up at, the shift was 4 to midnight. So I would show up at 4 o'clock, still hungover, and I would tell my buddy, I'd say, man, I'm not gonna drink today, tonight. And his answer was, I'll alert the media. So, because he knew better. Because lunchtime was at like 8 o'clock at night. By lunchtime, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. By 10 o'clock, I'm already plotting what I'm going to do when I get off work. I'd go hit that Arco station on 10th and Lacey, I think it is. And I'd buy me a 12-pack for the trip home. Once I got here, I would hit the 7-Eleven on Court and Walnut. And make so I didn't run out before or after 2 o'clock. And I would stay up every night drinking and doing that other stuff. And sometimes, you know, the kids would get up every morning and see all the empties on the coffee table. And sometimes they would almost find other things, but the old lady would catch it, you know. And so it just, things got worse and worse. When I started doing that other stuff, things just got worse and worse. And then all of a sudden I started getting sick. I started getting these bouts where I couldn't breathe, and I was coughing up blood. And I remember on my 40th birthday, it's like blood was coming out other areas, which I'm not going to go into detail. But I was in bad shape. And I went to this doctor, this cardiopulmonary specialist, and he said, well, I think you just got reoccurring pneumonia. And he gave me a shot of penicillin or some kind of antibiotic and sent me home. And I'd feel pretty good. And then a few days later, I couldn't breathe again. And when I started coughing up blood, I panicked. You know, I'm like, man, something's really wrong here. You know, but it didn't stop me from doing any of the things I was doing. So after a few times of this, going to see this doctor, they took me to the hospital over in Tulare and did that thing, I forget what they call it, where they shove the camera down your throat and look around, you know. And they were doing all kinds of things, couldn't figure out what was wrong. So then I had this attack on a weekend, and the wife took me to the emergency room here in town at the Cahuilla Delta, and they discovered it right away. They're like, your heart's enlarged, your liver's enlarged, you've got congestive heart failure. So they put me in the hospital, they kept me in the hospital, and they brought in the cardiologist, Dr. Stislowski, and he put me on some medications to make my heart beat stronger and something for my blood pressure and a diuretic to get rid of the fluid that was collecting around my heart. And I started feeling better. After about 3 days, they turned me loose. And I told myself, it's like, I'm done. I'm gonna clean up my act. I'm killing, you know, I was dying, literally. And that lasted about 2 weeks. And this is a point I want to make about the cunning, baffling, powerful. Even knowing that I was going to die, and it's not like someday you're going to die. It's like any day you're going to die. I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And so I'm back to doing this, you know. And one night, you know, I was one of them guys that's out tweaking out in my garage all the time and everything. So I'm out there. I think I was waiting. I forget. It was like 6 in the morning or something. I was waiting for the corner store. I live near the Victorian. Anybody familiar with the Victorian?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was waiting for that place to open up so I could go over there and get me a couple of tall cans because I was wired, you know, and I needed to level off. So I know this makes a lot of sense, but while I was waiting, I figured I'd do another line. So I had this mirror on the seat of my bike, and I'm getting ready to do this line, and I'm just getting ready to do it, and I stop. I'm already on my knees. And I said, I hate this shit. And I prayed right there. I said, God, please take this away. And then I did my line. And I went to the store and got my beer. And a couple of weeks later, I found myself, after one failed attempt at contacting somebody, I found myself walking into the Nooners group of the Ilano Club. And I sat there and I listened to some people. At the time, Sammy, any of you know Sammy? She was the secretary. John Taylor was chairing. And I was listening. And John, back then he had a full beard and he looked different. He was I don't know why I mentioned that, but he was smiling, you know, and he was happy. And I didn't hear the I wanted what he had thing yet. I hadn't heard that yet, but I wanted what he had. And what he had was he was happy. He appeared to be happy. So I grabbed him after the meeting because, I didn't mention, I had a brush. I kind of knew what I needed to do because I had a slight brush with AA back in the late 70s when my sister's friend's father, who I discovered was one of us, took me to a meeting. But it didn't last long. You know, they started talking about God and stuff, and I didn't like that. So, and I said, well, I got the book and everything. You know, I can do this. And that doesn't work. If anybody wants to try that, it doesn't work. So, anyway, I grabbed John after the meeting, and I asked him, you know, to be my sponsor. And he didn't really give me a yes or no answer. He said, let's get you some phone numbers. So he got me. He started going around. I got this little Ilano Club card. I think I still have it at home. And it's got these names on it, like Larry Sloan, Grass, I think you're on there. I think Albert's on there. There's a few people that are on there. Some of them aren't with us anymore. And then he said the thing, you know, you get a book, you know, we'll get you a book, read the first 100, or I already had a book, so he goes, read the first 164 pages, and 90 meetings in 90 days, and, you know, all that stuff you hear. So I'm like, okay. And I didn't do any of it. But I stayed sober, you know, for a while. But I remember one day telling him, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to want to drink again. And I was after a meeting, and he goes, you will. And for some reason, that, like, kind of pissed me off or whatever. And it gave, like, as soon as I got out of that meeting, I went and got some beer. And so I drank for a little more, you know. And then I stopped again. I went and told him, I go, I'm having trouble with the third step. I'm still drinking. And I'm telling him, I'm having trouble with this third step. I don't really understand it. And he goes, well, yeah, that's because you haven't done the first two. So, and then he goes, have you done the 90 meetings in 90 days? No. Have you been going to meetings every day? No. Have you been calling me every day? No. All these things that he told me I was supposed to do, I wasn't doing. So then that pissed me off in a different way. It's like, all right, I'm going to show you, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to do this, So... I got serious and I started doing the things he told me to do, and I stayed sober, well, for a while. I forgot. I had one relapse. That was I was out working on my car one day, on my truck, and it was kind of a warm day. And I told this one too. Sorry, guys, you guys that were there the couple weeks ago. I was working on my truck, and all of a sudden I felt someone tugging at my pant, like something tugging at my pant leg. And I looked down, and it's this little Hispanic girl, and she's got a Bud Long neck, and she's going like this with the big brown eyes, and the condensation's running down the sides, and it's ice cold, and I didn't want to be rude and refuse it, because I looked down, I looked down like a couple of doors down, and her dad is down there waving at me. He sent it down. I didn't want to be rude. So I said, thank you, honey. And I took the beer, and I walked in my garage, and I set it on my workbench. And I wasn't going to drink it. But it was calling me, and it was hot. By the time I drank it, it was hot. And then I was off again for a little bit. But then I got serious, and I started doing what my sponsor told me, and I was determined to stay sober, and I did. I managed to stay sober for 12 years. I was going out to the prisons doing H&I work out of Corcoran Prison. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. Me and Brewster used to go out to Corcoran Prison all the time. And I remember that's where one time, I don't know if you remember this, Brewster. It's one time I felt the presence of God in that prison. We were having a meeting in Echo Yard in this little room with a bunch of these inmates. We were all sitting in a circle, and I can't explain it, man. We were just all talking, and we connected, and it's like I felt it. I felt it. I'm getting goosebumps right now. On the way home, I wouldn't even turn the radio on. I didn't want the radio on. I didn't want to lose that feeling that I had. And I knew God was with me. And so anyway, I was doing everything I was supposed to do, and then, as they say, shit happened. It's like I lost my job. They closed that Pirelli plant and stuff, and I was moving around to these different jobs. I was back on a night shift and everything, and I stopped doing the 12 steps in reverse, starting with the 12th on down. And I ended up drinking again for about a year in 2007. In April, I think, of 2007, I went out. And in April of 2008, I came back. I remember my wife telling me when I was like 5 years sober, she said, we were driving somewhere, and she said, I just want you to know that I'm the happiest I've ever been because you're sober. And if I were to die today, I just want you to know I'm the happiest I've ever been. And I broke her heart because I went out there and got drunk again. I would come home drunk, lay down in the bed next to her, and she'd go, you're drunk again, aren't you? And I said, yeah, but I'm going to quit. And I told her that about three times before I finally did quit again. And That's a funny story too. You know, I went to my first meeting, and Sandy was there, gave me a big hug, and we were standing there doing the closing prayer, you know, the Lord's Prayer at the end. And when I opened my eyes, David Looper's standing in front of me, smiling. And he goes, "Where you been?" And I go, "Well, I've been out there again." And he's like, he said, "You know, when you have cancer, if you have cancer and you've been in remission and then you relapse, you don't quit going to the doctor because you're ashamed. You get help. And alcoholism is the same way. It's a disease." And he's right. And so I started out again. I asked Holden to be my sponsor. And me and Holden went through the steps together. And Holden was an awesome sponsor, you know, because he not only was my sponsor, he was my friend. He wouldn't wait for me to call him. Sometimes he'd piss me off because he's kind of pushy, you know. He'd call me up and go, "Hey, let's go over here." And I'm like, "I don't want to go." And he'd go, "Come on," you know. And he'd be kind of pushy about it. But I'd go, you know, and I'd always be glad I did. I never went to Richie Barn until he pushed me into that. You know, all those years I was sober, I never did anything but go to meetings at that Nooners group, really, and then a couple of meetings out of town and stuff, you know. Never worked with anyone. And I'm going to touch on that. How much time do I got? 2 minutes. Well, I'm doing a lot of what it was like and everything, and I want to get into how it is now and what happened and how it is now. And what happened was I sat down across the table with another man and went over this page by page, line by line. And I had homework to do every week. And I learned this book. People sit in these meetings and they hear people like me up here like talking, telling you stuff and everything. I heard a woman say one time, "Keep it simple, stupid," just like it says in the big book. Keep it simple, stupid. It doesn't say that anywhere in the big book. You know, we need to look in here ourselves and find out what's in here. This disease is cunning, baffling, powerful, and I have to stay in. Last March, my wife died. I was married for 35 years. Am I going to talk too much about this? Because I did this on the last time I spoke, and the whole room turned into a big blubber fest, so I'm not going to do it again. But I have to touch on this. She died last March. And I've never sponsored more than one person at a time. Right after she died, I've got 4 people I'm sponsoring now, and I'm maybe got a 5th that wants me to sponsor them. That's a God thing, folks. When I was told by the doctor, sitting in the room with my wife, that she was going to die, I was supposed to meet a guy. We met every Saturday at 4:00. And I was getting ready to leave to go meet him. I was going to leave her for an hour and go meet him and then come back. She was in ICU. And I knew the doctor wanted to talk to me. So, but he wasn't around. But when I was getting ready to leave, I was walking out and I saw him and I said, "Did you want to talk to me?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Come on." He goes, he took me back in the room and we sat down in a couple of chairs. And he said, "She's not going to make it." He said, "What's going on with her heart? It's like she has to be on this. And there's no pill to replace this. And there's no surgery. And so he explained all this stuff to me and everything, and I had to make the decision whether to pull the plug or not, whether to take her off life support. First thing I did was I said, okay, and then I said, I got to leave for about an hour. I'll be back. And I went and worked with my sponsee, and I came back and started calling the kids and stuff. You know, I've got one daughter that lives way up near Oregon, and I got one daughter that lives in Oregon, and I'm calling all of them and saying, you need to get down here, you know. And but the point I'm making is I went and met with my sponsor. Some people might think that's kind of callous or whatever, but like I told my sponsor, I kind of used that on him. I said, look, I left my wife's deathbed to come work with you because this is just as important. This is life and death just like that is. And I said, don't let me down. So I remind him of that all the time. And he's doing well. And that's another thing, too. You know, it's like so far, everybody I'm working with is staying sober. And I've got one that we're almost done. We're almost through the 12th step. He's working on, he's getting back to me, and we're going to do 10 and 11 probably next week. And then the others are right behind him. And everybody's staying sober. And one of the things, that's God. That's not me. That's God, and that's this book. I sit down with them, and we go over this. You know, we probably take 4 to 6 months just on the first step. Because the first step to me is the most important, because so many people, if you're new here, make sure you believe that first step. Make sure you believe that you're powerless over alcohol, that your life has become unmanageable, because a lot of us, including myself, don't. We say the words, but we're still looking for loopholes up here in this alcoholic brain of ours. We're still looking for loopholes. That time when I went out, when I had all them years sober, I would pack little things away, little tidbits of information away that I would hear. One guy would tell me, yeah, you know, I used to go to AA, but I stopped. And I've been sober for 18 years. I put that in my head. It's like, maybe I can do that. You know, I can't, because I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm the one that talks about in here. I'm the one that gets that phenomenon of craving it talks about in this book. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about the phenomenon of craving. And that's not when you're thinking about drinking. That's when you've already got some in you and you can't stop. That's me. I get the slightest amount of alcohol in me and it's on and cracking. I'm not stopping. Other people can stop. Other people can put it away. You heard Brewster read in the chapter 3 about, you know, go out there and test yourself. Go out to a bar and try doing a little controlled drinking. Try drinking a couple and then stopping. See how it works out. That time I went out in 07, when I went out and started drinking again, I would come home bragging to the old lady. Yeah, I had like 2 beers and came home. She's like, oh, that's great. You know, I know it was breaking her heart. But it didn't last. It didn't last. It just progressed, you know. Pretty soon, you know, I was going to Applebee's over on Acres. I was trying to fit in at this new job I got. I was going to Applebee's with these guys and drinking after work. And pretty soon, you know, they were going home to their wives, and I was staying there making new friends. They're probably annoying people is really what I was doing. But that's me. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. Once I start drinking, I'm not stopping. I'm watching family members. I got a family member now that's doing the same thing. And I can't do anything but be an example to her, you know, and be there for her when she's ready. And she's not ready. Anybody says anything to her, she gets hostile. So, anyway, I think I'm probably running out of time, but I just want to say, you know, it's like, if you're new here, stick around. No matter what they make you do, it's been done before. And just get with somebody and listen and do what they say and make sure it's somebody that sits down and goes over this book with you. And that's all I got. Thanks.